I have a confession to make. I like to do things myself. I'm not always very good at asking for help. Two places this especially shows up. One is a big store like Walmart. Now, I know that if I would just ask someone for help, I could find the thing I need right away and move on with my day. I don't like to do that. I would rather just do it myself. And so sometimes I'll wander around aimlessly for 15, 20, 30 minutes before I finally stumble upon this item. That's just how I like to do it. It's the principle of the thing for me. I like to do it myself. The other scenario is navigating in the car. Now, it's not quite as bad as it used to be. We've been in DFW now for over 5 years. I most of the time generally know where I am. I can figure it out. But when we first moved here, that wasn't the case. I didn't have any idea where I was most of the time. My GPS was old. It didn't know either. That was before I had a smartphone, so I actually had to buy one of those things that's a paper map, you know, that you fold out. Have you ever seen one of those? But I'm from a town of 7,000 people. So looking at all those interstates and highways and roads that have the same name, but they're not actually the same road, you can see how that was a little overwhelming. The good news was that Noelle was new also. So she didn't have any idea where we were either. So there were times when I could get away with being utterly lost. But if I could just figure out where I was eventually, I could get us back on the right track and I wouldn't have to admit that I was actually lost. Eventually, though, she caught on to my game. And the inevitable question would come, are you lost? Now, I would not lie, but I would insist, okay, maybe this wasn't exactly where I was planning to go, but this looks familiar. I can get us back on track. I'm fine. I can do it myself. But then, as the same building passed us 2-3 times, that intersection starts looking pretty familiar, my game is up. And that's when I'd have to pull over, have to pull out a map or ask for help. I could no longer do it by myself. Whether it's in a store or driving, I like to handle things myself. And I have complete confidence in my ability to figure it out. But I shouldn't. I often need help. I just don't always like having to rely on someone else to give it to me. Something tells me I'm not the only one. You know, call it stubbornness, call it ego, or whatever. There's something about us that just doesn't always like to rely on other people. We like to take care of ourselves. We like to feel like we're the ones in control, that we can handle whatever comes our way. And it's our confidence in our abilities, in our efforts, that's what gives us hope. And so we do everything we can to rely on what we can do. Sure, there are other people who could help us. You know, they could probably even do it better than we could. But it's hard to put our confidence in what someone else might do. Because it's a lot easier to put our confidence in what we think we can do. Now, when we're talking about Walmart runs and car rides, this tendency seems innocent enough. But is it possible that this mentality could begin to creep into our identity as the people of God? That this kind of self-reliant, pull us up by our own bootstraps mindset could begin to define how we think about ourselves as people of God, and that we could actually begin to depend less and less on our King and more on ourselves. Our culture constantly pulls us in that direction, doesn't it? I mean, on the news, we hear of more mass violence and we hear of corruption and doom and gloom, and the list goes on and on. And then, especially with the current political environment, everything you hear wants to make us believe that our country, our world is on the very brink of catastrophe. And then there's our daily experience that really only feeds that. Financial troubles have us concerned. Trouble at work weighs on our mind, and perhaps we're experiencing personal tragedy that just gnaws on our soul. Earlier this morning, we confessed together that we're looking forward to the day when the rule of God covers the earth, when Jesus will reign, when he will make all things right. But when confronted with the realities of this life, we find ourselves tempted to look everywhere but to King Jesus for the help we seek. In fact, we may even wonder if it's worth putting any confidence in him at all. Is he really the king we need? Can we really trust that he is going to bring us the hope that we so desperately seek? 3,000 years ago, the people of Israel found themselves in similarly distressing situation. You see, the king they had chosen to lead them had failed miserably. He had been rejected by God, and without God's blessing on that king, who was going to shepherd the people? Who was going to administer justice for them? Perhaps even more pressing, who was going to be the one to fight for them? Who was going to protect them from the enemies that constantly surrounded them? You see, they had tried everything they could to get the kind of peace and security that they had desired through their means. But that had blown up in their faces. And now they're basically back at square one. Who was going to be their next king? And what assurance did they have that he was going to be any different, any better than their last one? Hope for God's blessing seemed dim. But as we'll see in our text for this morning, the people of God did indeed have reason for hope. Because not only would they get a new king, but they could be confident that this king was exactly the one they needed. How could they be so confident? And what does that king have to do with our hope in King Jesus? Let's explore this together as we dive into 1 Samuel 16. 1 Samuel 16, where we're going to see two reasons that Israel could have confidence in their new king. And the first reason we're going to find is in verses 1 through 12. Where we see that Israel could have confidence in their new king because he was chosen by God. Let's start in verse 1. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons." Now, right off the bat, we're reminded that Saul has been rejected as king. Last week, Victus walked us through that text in chapter 15, where we saw that Saul's partial obedience resulted in the kingdom being taken away from him to be given to another. Now, we're not going to see that actually come to fruition for quite a while, but the wheels are in motion now. And apparently, Samuel is still fairly hung up over Saul's rejection. Now, that's understandable, right? If you think about what Samuel had invested in that kingship, it was quite a lot. He was the one who had anointed him as king, so perhaps he feels like there's some responsibility on his part for what had happened. But he was also the one that had to confront him at least twice about his sin as king. So you can understand why it might take Samuel a little while to get beyond this failure. But a gentle admonishing from the Lord lets him know that time for grieving is over, because there's work to be done. And his task is now to anoint a new king over Israel. But already we see one major difference from the first time he anointed a king and what this one would be like. That's clear at the end of verse 1. "For I have provided for myself a king among his sons." Remember, Saul was chosen by the people. God allowed him to be made king, but he was not God's choice. Now, Saul could have been a great ruler. Okay, the pieces were in place, but he failed to follow God as he should. And so as you're the people of Israel, you can almost imagine them thinking, okay, if he's been rejected, we're going to eventually get a different king. Why is there any reason for us to think that this new king would be any different than the other one? Well, we're starting to see the signs already in verse 1. The difference? This king would be chosen by God. That he would be God's choice becomes even more clear as we continue in the text. Because not only was God going to handpick this king, he was also going to orchestrate the events that led up to finding him. Look at 2 through 5. And Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me." And the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' And invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint for me him whom I declare to you." Samuel did what the Lord commanded and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to meet him trembling and said, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably. I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." And he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. Now, Samuel isn't opposed to obeying what God's asked him to do, but you could understand if he was maybe a little cautious of how King Saul might respond here. We're going to find out in a few chapters that Saul has quite a problem with both anger and jealousy. That's a pretty dangerous combination if you are suspecting that somebody else is trying to anoint a king to take your place. Okay, so we can understand how Samuel might be a little bit cautious about this task that the Lord has given him. But he is not to fear, because the Lord has given him a cover story of sorts. Because while a sacrifice isn't the main focus of what Samuel is about to do, he is nevertheless going to sacrifice. So that's a legitimate thing that he's going to tell Saul he will do. And so this is not a lie here. The focus of the text is that God has clearly planned this out. And he is intent on making sure that his choice for king, that's going to become a reality. It's also clear what we saw in verse 3. Did you notice the personal pronouns that were used? "I will show you. You shall anoint for me him whom I declare." There's no doubt here. God is in charge of this choice, and he's going to make sure that it goes exactly as he wants it to. And that's just what happened. Samuel arrives at the city. He runs into no interference from Saul or the elders of the town. Jesse and his sons are there exactly as they should have been. And so Samuel prepares them for the sacrifice, and he's ready. He's ready to do what God had asked him to do, to anoint the next king of Israel. And that's where the story really gets interesting, starting in verse 6. When they came, he looked on Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Samuel. And he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Then Jesse made Shema pass by, and he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." And Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel, and Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." So if you picture the scene here, I mean, we don't know exactly what it looked like, but you've got some elders gathered around, you've got Samuel there, you've got Jesse, you've got his sons, and you can see Samuel kind of surveying the lot, kind of seeing what he can find, and then there's Eliab. And one look at him, and I've got to think he's thinking, jackpot. I mean, the Lord made this sound so complicated. He was so serious and matter of fact and made it sound all hard to do, but this was a lot easier than I thought it was going to be. I mean, you can imagine why. We don't know exactly what Eliab looked like, but based on Samuel's reaction and what we saw in verse 7, at the very least, you figure the guy's pretty tall. He's got some muscles bulging through his cloak. Maybe he's got some battle wounds on his face that speak of his time in war. This was an impressive dude. Okay, he's the kind of guy that if you end up in a dark alley late at night, you want him on your side. This had to be it. It was clear. This must be the next king of Israel. Think back to gym class. Do y'all remember gym class? You'd be playing a sport, whatever it might be, and you'd have two captains who would each pick a team, and then you would play each other. Well, there inevitably, you know, as it got around to everybody, you would get to be a captain, which meant you got to help pick the team that you wanted. And every now and then that coin flip went just right, and you got to be the first one to pick. And there was always that one student in the class. It didn't matter what sport it was. They were good at everything. And you wanted him or her on your team because you knew they were going to instantly make you better at whatever you were playing. And when it was your turn to pick and that stud person was available, you just knew, that's the one. Everybody would know it. It was the clear choice. And so it seemed with Eliab. Who else could there be but this guy? So you can imagine Samuel's surprise when his easy pick turned out to be too easy. We saw in verse 7 what the problem was. But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." You see, Samuel was looking only at the physical attributes that Eliab have. And God lets him know that the way he's going to choose this next king, it's not going to be by common convention. It's just one more sign that whoever this king would end up being, he would be God's choice, not man's. Because if you remember, how was Saul chosen? It was almost purely on his physical stature, right? He was tall, maybe impressive looking. And how did that turn out? No, God's king would be chosen based on more than just size and strength. The Lord would also consider the heart. And Samuel found that out as he takes a look at the seven sons, each one passing by him thinking, "Ah, surely this must be the one. Okay, now this must be the one." And on and on and on until, inexplicably, there's no one left. Every son had gone by and not one of them had been chosen by God. Now, if you're reading this for the first time, probably a couple of questions that pop into your mind. Hold on a second. Had God sent him to the wrong family? Did he change his mind? Has something gone wrong? No, not at all. Instead, we see in the next two verses that God's choice just hadn't yet been considered. And when his identity is finally revealed, there is no doubt that he was God's hand-picked choice. Let's pick up the story back in verse 11. Then Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all your sons here?" And he said, "There remains yet the youngest, but behold, he is keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and get him, for we will not sit down till he comes here." And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. And the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." Now to understand how really shocking this is here, we've got to put ourselves in the customs of the ancient Near East. Because to us, it might seem a little bit unorthodox to pick this youngest son for this task. You know, we're kind of used to the system of hierarchy by age and gender at times, but we could get over that. You know, if somebody else is more well qualified for the job, sure, we'll give it to them, no big deal. Well, that's just not how it worked in this time. That's not what you did. The birth order was a major consideration for any kind of blessing, any kind of choice. And if you're going to drift from that, it's just not what you did. Now, I will say, a few times in Israel's history, we do see the younger son being chosen, being given a blessing over the older son. But even at that, it caused quite a stir, and we're only talking about two people there. This is seven other brothers who got passed over in favor of the youngest. And the fact that David wasn't even invited to this initial gathering ought to tell us something too. Because apparently his own father thought his chances were so slim of getting chosen, he didn't even want to take him away from his work out in the field. If the reader hasn't gotten the picture by now, I don't know what else would make the point any clearer. God has ignored every convention in the book to make his choice. Why? Because he wants it to be known without a shadow of a doubt that this was his king. He had chosen him. He had orchestrated his appointment. Not man, God. I mean, was it understandable that the Israelites might be a little bit worried about this king? Well, sure. I mean, their first one had been an utter failure. And the success of this next king was going to help determine the trajectory of their future. But the way God chose this king sends a strong message. Because in essence, if you think about it, he's really almost putting his entire reputation on the line for this new king. It was his choice. He led all the way up to it. There's no mistaking it. There's no blaming it on the people. This was God's choice. If he doesn't work out, all eyes are on the Lord for some answers. And the fact that he's willing to stake his name on David tells you he's going to turn out just fine. And as we're going to find out as we continue in 1 and 2 Samuel, that's exactly what had happened. Israel could have confidence in their new king because he was chosen by God. Does any other God that, any other king that God chose come to mind? One who was perhaps a bit unorthodox of a choice? Some might say even an unbelievable choice for a king? One who was so clearly chosen by God that there is no mistaking it? Consider Jesus, God's ultimate king. As we've just got done celebrating, his birth was prophesied for hundreds of years. It worked out exactly as it was foretold, down to the detail of the family he would come from, even the very town he was born in. Yet he came with little fanfare. And few recognized him for who he really was. He displayed no military might to speak of. And to the disappointment of many who followed him, he allowed himself to experience a humiliating death. According to every convention, King Jesus was a failure. A terrible choice for a king. But we know that his resurrection from the dead proved once and for all that in the Father's eyes, he was anything but a failure. In fact, he was just the one, the only one fit to be king of the universe. Friends, this life is hard. Sin beats us down. We feel the effect of the fall all around us. And it can really be tempting sometimes to wonder where this King Jesus is in the midst of all of this. It's tempting to ask ourselves questions like, if he is such a great king, why don't we see evidence of his kingdom here on the earth? It seems like so little is going right with the world. Can we really trust him with our lives? These are tough questions. And often there are no easy answers. But one thing we do know for sure is that Jesus was God's unmistakable choice to be our king. And though we may not always understand his timetable, we might not always understand his methods for how he is going to bring this king's rule to us on earth, we can trust him. He knows what he's doing, and this king, despite what it may seem, is indeed God's chosen king. There's one more part of the picture, though, that we see in the text. As we look at who Israel's new king would be, there's yet one more reason why Israel could have confidence in this new king. Because not only had God chosen this king, but also God's presence would be with this king. We see this assurance in verse 13. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. And Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. You see, God was not just going to choose David and then leave him to figure out everything on his own. He was going to be with him. But the presence of the Spirit here, it's more than just accompaniment. You also have the idea of empowerment. Because not only would God be with this king, he would also empower him and strengthen him to do what he was calling him to do. So Israel need not worry whether this new king could hack it, whether he could handle it, whether he could really do the job. He wasn't going at it alone. The Spirit of the living God would be with him wherever he went, to guide him and to empower him. And our King, Jesus, he's more than just accompanied by God's Spirit. He is, in fact, one with the Father in the Spirit. He's been given full authority by the Father. He is seated in power at his right hand at this very moment. And friends, nothing that we do here on this earth, nothing that happens to us here on this earth escapes his gaze. And he is but waiting for the time when he will return with all of his unimaginable glory, and he will rule this earth, and all that is now wrong will be made right. Do we believe that? I mean, really, do we really believe that he is our one true king and that he is worthy of our confidence? That though we do not now see him ruling on the earth, that we wait for that day in hope, trusting that he will do as he has promised? Do we believe that? I must confess, though I say I believe that, my actions and attitudes often betray that my confidence really lies elsewhere. When I think about all that could go wrong with my son's birth next month, I am quick to put my confidence in doctors and in medicine and technology, not King Jesus. When I ponder the future of this country, the future of our world, the environment that my children, my grandchildren are going to grow up in, I am quick to put my confidence in politicians' promises of prosperity in the world's definition of security. Not King Jesus. And so I trust that for us, our text has been particularly real this morning. Because we need reminded that God has indeed chosen a king for his people. And that this King Jesus is absolutely worthy of our full confidence, no matter what convention says, no matter how our culture may try to tell us otherwise. And so for us this morning, as we go out from here, what would it look like to be a people whose confidence is strongly in our King? That our confidence in King Jesus might push us to pray. Whether it's something as mundane as parenting advice, or something as urgent as a crisis. That we would be quick to pray, that we would be quick to look not to what we can solve, what we can scheme, what we can figure out, but that we would look to King Jesus and what he can provide in response to our prayer. That our confidence in King Jesus might push us to greater contentment. That we would seek first his kingdom. That we would seek what he can provide for us. And that as we rest in what he has done for us and what we trust he will do for us in the future, we might with Paul confidently say that we have learned in whatever situation we are in to be content. And finally, that our confidence in King Jesus might lead us to greater security in him. That we would not fall prey to the fears of this world, but that we would be reminded and comforted and drawn to throw ourselves into the arms of our King, knowing that in him we find true peace and hope that we seek. Friends, our King has risen, and more than that, he is coming again. And so as we go out from here this morning, we do confidently proclaim that we are waiting for the day when the rule of God covers the earth. And day by day, may our hope and confidence grow all the more sure that King Jesus is that hope as we wait for him and the day that he returns. Father, we are so tempted to look everywhere else but to our King for what we need. We are quick to rely on ourselves. We are quick to rely on what we can do and look all sorts of places, neglecting the King who is right there in front of us all the time and who offers us what we need. And so we ask that you would encourage our hearts, that you would strengthen us in the face of difficulty, in the face of trials, in the face of discouragement. That our gut reaction would be to turn to King Jesus and what he can provide for us. We know confidently you have chosen him. He is our King. We ask for your grace to trust him more and reach out to him for hope as we go forth in this world. In Jesus' name, amen.